Right, Kevin Foster, side three. Kevin Foster, side three. You can't expect me to do that. I am an officer, he said.
Yeah. So I says that I sent the lads off and I says, ooh, look at this lads, we've got an officer. Can't have him paint the decks, can we? I says, right, get a bucket of suds, start scrubbing up the scuppers, the old drains. And I says, when you finish scrubbing them, I want every one of them brass drain covers polished. And they better be gleaming. And I says, if you want to argue about that, we'll go and have a chat with the first lieutenant. And then I actually reported to the petty officer who was in charge of them, these officers under training, who then reported to the officer who was in charge of these baby officers. And he was warned, any time again, when a naval seaman gives him an order and he doesn't obey it, he'll be kicked straight out. So after that, he shut his mouth and got on with the jobs that were given them.
Okay. So, you finished that. Just tell me, how is that done now, the training of naval officers on ships? I thought they just went to Dartmouth and that was it.
No, they still will. Well, it's 7 weeks to do at sea training.
After Dartmouth?
That's part of the Dartmouth training.
Is it? Okay.
Now, a lot of that training, they have
that's
to...
That's still the case?
Yeah, but yeah. So they do a week with each department, like electricians,
okay.
A week in the ops room, a week in the seamen's part.
Right. So what happened after that?
Right, after that, this was going up towards that 1981.
Right.
1981, I was then drafted off the Norfolk.
Which month?
This would have been December.
Right. December 81?
November 81 I was drafted off.
Right.
I was on leave again.
Yes.
And then I was told to report to HMS Cardiff on January the 4th again, 1982.
Right.
I joined the Cardiff.
As a radio operator.
A radar operator.
Radar, yeah.
Now, because I was a bosun's yeoman, qualified regular sailmaker, they actually wanted me to work with the Buffers Party. But they already had a lad working there, although he wasn't trained up as a bosun yeoman. They said, we're going to give you a job working at the dining hall party for 3 months. Then when the job changes, come back round again after 3 months, we'll stick your Buffers Party. And I says, right, fine, we'll go for that. We'll sail on the February the 22nd, 1982, for the Gulf Patrol, for the Iran-Iraq War. That was on protection for the oil tankers coming through.
Yeah. Were you looking forward to that?
Well, we was all looking forward to it.
Yeah.
We actually got into Bahrain, then we went into Mombasa for 2 weeks.
Right.
We got 6 days leave apiece.
Sorry?
Six days station leave apiece,
right,
in Mombasa.
That was good?
That was good, it was, but we had the bad news when we was out there in Mombasa, because the Falklands War just started.
So that would have been April? Yeah.
And the Argentinians put on the radio that HMS Cardiff had been sunk at the Falklands. Which was news to us because we was in Mombasa alongside at the time.
Right.
So,
they invaded on April the 1st or
yeah,
2nd?
The 2nd round at that time. We was in Mombasa.
During April. You were on the 2nd of April, you were actually in Mombasa.
We was in Mombasa at the time,
so,
yeah.
Tell me what happened after that.
So then, the news was actually going round the place that we was going down to the Falklands. Another ship was going to come out and relieve us for the Gulf.
Hmm.
But then we sailed from Mombasa and went to Mogadishu. And just before we sailed from Mombasa, we were actually told the news confirmed we'd be going out the Falklands.
Hmm.
And a lot of lads wanted to get down there,
hmm,
because this would be our first chance to fight in a war.
Hmm.
And went down to Mombasa, we were stuck down there, saying, well, what are we doing here?
Hmm.
If the war was going out the Falklands. Went from Mombasa to Mogadishu, in Somalia, we stayed there for a couple of days, and then we went from there to Al Hodeida in Yemen, which was an even bigger tip than Mogadishu was, and then suddenly we turned back round again and up the Red Sea. We waited for 2 days there while we were waiting to get clearance to go through the Suez Canal. We got through the side, went to Gibraltar, rearmed, refuelled. We had extra crew members came on board while we were short in the past. Now a lot of lads were due to leave the ship, but the captain wasn't prepared to let them go because he didn't want a lot of new blokes coming on board who didn't know the job properly, and he wanted the ship working as a team. And then that's when we headed down to the Falklands and joined up with the...
What did you feel about that then, yourself?
I was looking forward to it myself.
Right, okay. And what about these blokes that wanted to leave? I mean, so presumably some of them might have been going to non-hazardous postings, to say the least.
Yeah, a lot of them were, but I mean... I think even that, because they were going to war, a lot of them said, oh, fine, I'd rather go to the war than get drafted away to a dry on Nelson Barracks or some place like that.
Right. Okay. So, refit all the rest of it in jib, and then what happens?
Then we sailed, joined up with HMS Bristol, who was in charge of the... There was a squadron leader for the second group going down, and we joined up with that group. We actually arrived in the total exclusion zone on May the 22nd, 82.
Right.
And within 4 hours of arriving there, we'd fired off two Sea-Dart missiles.
Right.
At an RG Boeing 747.
What was that doing?
The RGs were actually using it as a reconnaissance aircraft, long-range reconnaissance. Now, at that time, I was on the upper deck because my off-watch action station was 20mm gun crews. So we went to action stations. I went to the 20mm crews, gun crews. There's me and my loader was Tosh Turnbull. But what we used to do was each action station would swap rounds. One would be the loader, one would be the gunner, to give each other a chance on the guns. Mm. And we could see the aircraft on the horizon flying across. And the Bristol wouldn't give up permission to open fire. Now, at this stage, it was only about 25 miles from the ship. You could see it quite clearly. So then it disappeared. Oh, Captain Harris, his name was, he asked permission to go back to look for this aircraft. So we were given permission. We left the group, headed back north again, and the aircraft circled around again. And this time the aircraft was at 33 miles distance from the ship when the captain opened up. If you had waited a few more minutes, it was actually coming towards the ship. But they fired two sea darts. Now, I remember through a gap in the clouds, I could see one of the missiles going off by itself, going haywire. It was like a Duff missile, and the second one carried on. And the lads down below in the ops room who saw it, they saw it heading on the radar towards the aircraft. And then it came up on the 909, which was the director's. The computer came up, forward 909, assessed hit. So there was a big cheer come from the ops room, we've hit it. We couldn't see nothing for the cloud coverage, but it came up with a broadcast, it's been hit, so we had a little big sing and dance on the upper deck. And then a few minutes later, it appeared on the radar again, 8 miles away and further down. So what they reckon they've done is we blew the arse end off it, or the tail off it. And the Argies have managed to get it back to base, but we never actually heard anything from it for the rest of the war. Mm. So they actually classed it as a possible kill on that one.
Was it that was just a jet liner, was it? Or was
a passenger plane.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Did you stop off at Ascension?
No, I went straight past it.
Straight on. So what happened after that?
So then we were on about May the 25th. They used to run a service from the different ships. It was a helicopter dispatch service. If your helicopter was going to one of their ships and you knew somebody on there, you had a letter for them, sir. You'd drop the letter off as he was heading across there. See if you send it all back to England through the system. Now, at the time, the Coventry was down there. My eldest brother, Jim, was on the Coventry. And that was the May 25th. I'd went up the hangar with a letter and I said, where's your helicopter? And they said, you've just missed it. And I said, what's that? I said, oh, it's a letter from my brother on the Coventry. So one of the crew members says, oh, they're going across there tomorrow. Leave the letter with us, and we'll drop the letter off for you. And I went off watch, got me head down. When I woke up, we heard the news that HMS Coventry had been sunk. And then it was like 24 hours waiting to hear whether my brother was still alive or not. And we'd heard within a few hours of the ship getting sunk, they had a list of survivors. Now, the reason they didn't give the list out was because a lot of it was the information. People were saying, all right, so-and-so's alive, I've saw him. Now, they might have said to me, your brother's still alive, just to find out later on that he died as he got picked out of the water. Because, for instance, the first lieutenant, one of the reports was the first lieutenant's alive. I saw him get, a lad said he saw him getting lowered over the side of the ship. Now, the first lieutenant's arm had been blown off in the blast from one of the bombs. And a couple of the lads were lowering him over the side on a piece of rope. Now, this lad who actually said that the first lieutenant was alive, he saw him getting lowered, he jumped over the side after that. And he didn't see what happened next was the rope snapped. The first lieutenant slid down the side of the ship and he got caught in the stabilisers, which were still moving, and he broke his neck and died instantly. But to all intents and purposes, this bloke actually told us who he saw, he was alive. So they couldn't actually put any lists out. And I'd been asking around if my brother was still alive. And it was one of the radio operators from the main communication officer, he came in and gave me the information. And he actually got a severe reprimand for giving me that information because he wasn't supposed to have done it. So then my brother left the Falklands. He got to actually went back on the QE2. But he told me a funny story down there.
So what happened to him then? He got out?
He was half blinded in his left eye. Yeah. He was, but that was like a flash blast.
Yes.
He was badly burnt and he was unconscious anyway. They discovered a lot of problems with them ships because they were in the ops room. And the only thing that saved them was the fact that somebody went down to the computer room below, and when he came back, he left the hatch open. So when the bombs hit the computer room, the blast went straight up, and a fireball came through the ops room. So a lot of lads were burnt and some were killed. But if I hadn't had the hatch open, it would have blew the whole deck through from below, because there would have been nowhere for the blast to go to. And it also buckled a lot of doors. So to get off the ship, they had to use sledgehammers to smash the clips open, because the doors were all buckled.
Right, and was he left with any permanent injuries? Or
no, none at all.
He got burnt, but
he got burnt, but it was he had a twitch in his eye for a while, the left eye. But that was it.
Well, that's very lucky. Yeah.
He was, but you told me a story about when the Sheffield got sunk. The company was one of the ships that picked up survivors. And they picked up this one bloke off the Sheffield. And they'd sent a signal to his wife saying, "It's all right, your husband's alive, he's quite safe. He's on the company." So,
he got killed on the Coventry.
No, what had happened was he was a radio supervisor and he spoke Spanish. So they said, "Do you want to stay down here? Because we need you to listen to the transmissions and translate them." So he says, "All right, I'll stay." So within a couple of weeks of getting sunk on the Sheffield, he was sunk again on the Coventry. And he got off the Coventry. And they said, "Do you want to stay down here?" He says, "No, twice is enough for me. I'm going home now." So he had enough of that one, and he went back on the QE2 with the rest of his fathers.
Right.
Then we started our job off there. It was picket duty with a carrier group, which was pretty boring. I mean, the amount of ships that were around, the Hermes and the Invincible, and the aircraft coverage and subs, there's nothing we could get near them. Now, at one stage, we had a Super 8 and Dad picked up on radar down to the south. And as we was on picket duty down to the south, there was the Cardiff, the Exeter, moved down there to intercept it. And the RG aircraft fired off an Exeter missile. We was at the time of the missile being fired, I was in the ops room. And we could see the missile coming in on the radar. And at the same time, HMS Avenger steamed up on my starboard side. We was firing our Sea Dart missiles, 4 or 5 guns, and even the 20 mils opened up. And then we heard the broadcast from the upper deck saying, Exeter, starboard inboard coming, take cover, take cover, take cover. And then it disappeared off the screen. Now, the Exeter had been firing at the missile, we'd been firing at it, and the Avenger came up and fired one shell from his 4-5 and hit the missile and blew it out. And then we were taking off carrier duties, because the Exeter had went up to San Carlos Bay. They spent a week there and started whining, and they'd been there for a week. Why weren't they replaced?
So you went into San Carlos?
So we went to San Carlos and took off from the Exeter.
Right.
And at the same time we went there, HMS Avenger went across as well.
Right.
And I seen that bit actually on television. It was the Canberra with the next set missile heading towards it. And then it was blown up before it hit the side of the ship. And that was the Avenger again with its 4-5 gun.
And you're saying that the gun actually hit the missile?
The gun fired one shell, 4-5 shell. It was a Mark Air 4-5 that carried the ships. It was a computerised gun.
Oh, right.
And both times that they fired, they took one shot at the next set, and each time they fired a shot, the two X sets cleared two of them out of the way.
One that was coming. Range, do you think? I don't know.
Well, the one that was coming towards us was only about 5 miles away from the ship.
But it was hit with a shell.
It was hit by a 4-5 shell on a 4-5 brick.
It's got a smart. It's got a smart.
No, it was just normal 4-5 shell that was fired by the gun.
Good gracious.
Then it fired later on. Fired one that. I've next set that was going for the camera and hit that one as well.
Right.
Then we went on duties at Grantham Sound.
Where is that?
This was just up from San Carlos Bay.
All right.
And we had permission to go at the night times to Cardiff to head up north between the two islands and go out to sea. We would be waiting on the west side of West Falklands and wait for the RG aircraft coming across. And then we're firing us from there. Mm-hmm. And we went up one night and we had 5 RG aircraft came in on the radar. So that we moved forward for the attack position with the sea darts and a Mark 8 4-5s. And then all of a sudden we lost power from the front end of the ship. Everything, computers went down, guns went, missile systems, everything. And it turns out it was a chief petty officer, electrician, had been he was actually making sure the power from front and stern generators were actually working properly. And he knocked the switch and turned all the power off to the front end of the ship.
So how long did that go on for?
Well, we had nothing. We had no weapons at all. We had no radar.
Yeah.
So all we could do was turn around and head back into shore for a bit of safety. But at the same time, we had the Avenger again actually came up.
Right.
And they opened up their guns. And we had another ship, I can't remember which one it was, came to the port side. And they took off the aircraft to give us a bit of coverage until we got out of the area. And it took about an hour before we could reload all the booking systems back in and all the computer programs. And then the chief petty officer was made to give a public apology over the ship's broadcasting for endangering the lives of the ship's company.
What happened to him afterwards?
He got a severe reprimand, and that was all he got for it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then during this time, we
How long was it that you got this? The power went down.
The power was out. The power came up straight away. But by this time, it had wiped everything out of the computer systems.
Oh, I see.
So we had nothing in it. So we had to reprogram everything we had. It took over an hour to get everything back online again.
Wasn't it backed up to a hard disk? Or?
No, we didn't have things like that. It was a big computer room down below, massive.
Oh, right.
We had a Hewlett-Packard in the ops room for the link system. Your link system would work for over 500 miles. Mm-hmm. So if you had that switched on, you could be, say, 500 miles away from the rest of the group. And if you got attacked, the ships behind them, as long as they were linked up with your system, they would know exactly what was expecting when they were up there.
Okay. So, what happened after that then?
After that, we had various attacks. Some like 5 attacks in 3 days. Hmm. We had a total.
What did you do during. What was your personal duty on the action station?
I was the. If I was already in the ops room, my job was above water warfare officer's assistant. And when I was off watch, when we went to action stations, I was on the 20mm aircraft guns.
Right.
Now, during the one stage, it was at night time, we fired a CDAT. And I was like right beside the AWO, the above water warfare officer, and the air picture supervisor. And you had the big tactical display. And we'd pick up on the radar a slow moving contact heading towards the ships. And now we actually called them up on radio. And we tried with IFF transponders on the ship, and we got no response at all.
Mm. Hold on, I mean, just identification, friend or foe, each of the aircraft has, so that you know whether it is.
That's it, yeah. So this aircraft should have had it switched on if it was a friendly, but there was nothing.
Yeah.
They ignored all radio messages, and they ignored the IFF as well.
Yeah.
So because of its speed, we thought it was a Bukhara coming across. So we fired 2 CDAT missiles out at it, and the first one missed. That was another Duff missile we had, went haywire, exploded on the hillside, and the second one hit it and took out the aircraft. Now, after the missile had been fired, the ops officer came into the ops room, and he was sitting right beside me, in between me and the AWO, and he actually said, right, what time was the missile fired? What were the weather conditions, sea state? You have to fill all these forms in. And he actually said, what bearing did he fire the missile on? And the AWO said, 265. And he wrote down 265, and then he went, shitty death, our troops are over there. And we later on found out that we'd shot down 1 Sea Kings, carrying 9 SAS troops. And it wasn't until 1985, when I was at the Legion, I read in a soldier magazine that had been sent out to Africa, that the families of the SAS personnel got compensation, but the pilot and the observer, their families got nothing, because it was their fault for not answering the radio calls.
But they hadn't put the transponder.
And they hadn't put the IFF on either. And it wasn't until a couple of days later we found out that we'd shot down 1 Sea Kings with a CDAT.
You found that a couple of days later?
A couple of days later we found that out, yeah.
Right.
And then
there was several other there was another helicopter full of SAS went down out there, wasn't it? Or was that the only one?
I think there was one went down on South Georgia.
Was it? I thought it was 18 people. They got 18 people into a Gazelle.
I think there was. They used a Wessex off HMS Antrim. He flew out. He did about 3 trips. He smashed one helicopter up, bought another one, and he went back.
And that went down.
He went down as well, and he managed to get. He got a load of them out, but it was really severe with the snowstorm and all them out there.
Yeah.
But he managed to get. I think he got about 18 of them out. He got all together, but a lot of them died in it with a crash.
Mm.
And then there was a. Just after that one, that was towards the end of the war. That one, in fact.
That crash.
When we took out the helicopter.
Right. What did the bloke say when they realised it was one of the old?
When we found out it was our own helicopter shot down, it was the captain did a speech on the broadcast system.
So what was his choice of words?
Well, he said it's not our fault. He tried to put across the crew that it wasn't our fault.
Mm.
We're not to blame. Mm. And he put across like all we can do was apologise to the families.
Mm.
He says, but there's not a great deal we can do apart from that.
Mm.
And the lads felt really bad about it. But he says, you just got to get on with the job, lads, and do your job that you're trained for.
Mm.
And then that was saved just towards the end of the war. And then the final missile we fired off was we fired it over land. And from what we were told, this was some kind of record for Sea-Dart missile, because we'd been heading north as usual to go on our night firing or picket duty out on the Falklands.
North of
east
or west Falklands.
But we went up the east this time.
All
right. And we went up there and was heading eastwards instead of westwards back out. So as we were heading north and turning on the top of the east, the RG aircraft came in from the bottom up by south of San Carlos.
Right.
As they were doing their run through it, we was talking the rapier batteries. The RF regiment had their rapier batteries, and we was actually talking to them on radio. And they'd been allocated these four targets, or it was the bird target as they were called, and they'd been allocated to the rapier batteries. But our captain wasn't having any of this. So we fired two Sea-Dart missiles off, 19,000 feet, at 33 miles over land, and we took the two lead aircraft out that were coming in. And I actually read this in a book that it was the Nolan Ferry, where the ships were, the aircraft were going into attack. And the captain of the Nolan Ferry wrote in the book, "I'll be eternally grateful to the captain and ship's company of HMS Cardiff, who destroyed two Argentine aircraft that were coming in to sink my ship." Then later on, just at the end of the war, I was taken off the Cardiff and transferred to an Argentinian patrol boat that we captured. It was called Islas Malvinas, or Falkland Islands in Spanish. And we renamed it the Tiger Bay, after the docks in Cardiff.
Yes.
And I was one of the crew members on this thing.
Why were you selected?
Well, it was, they needed one cook, one stoker for the engines, an electrician for the radar, that never worked. You had an officer in charge, and they needed two seamen. But they needed a seaman who knew what the job was. And because I was a qualified rigging sailmaker, I was also the coxswain of the ship and doing all the seamanship. But a lot of the time we spent there was ferrying troops back and forwards, mainly the SAS guys.
From where to where?
From different islands, taking them around from different jobs.
Right.
So we actually got into Port Stanley at the end of the war.
Right.
Now HMS Cardiff had went on the West Falklands and took the surrender of Port Howard.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
The Cardiff.
Yes.
They went on the West Falklands.
Yes.
And they took the surrender from Port Howard.
Right, Right,
now they had 1,000 Argentinian soldiers. Oh, but by the time they got there, the captain went ashore with a group of Royal Marines to take over the West Falklands. When they got there, there was only 999 Argentinians, because one of them had done a runner up in the hills. He decided he was going to be a John Wayne alone.
Right.
So they sent a couple of Royal Marines up there to give him a spanking and bring him back again. And then...
But you missed that, did you?
Well, we didn't go ashore there anyway. Yeah. The only one that went ashore was the captain and a leading seaman called Middy Middleton.
All right, but you were on board when the surrender of West Falklands?
Well, West Falklands.
You were on board when that happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we actually went round to the...
So you stood off Port Howard then?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And then what had happened was the Argies were...
Port Howard is very... I mean, there's five flats or something.
Yeah, something like that. There wasn't a great deal there. Yeah. But that's actually the capital of the West Falklands.
Yeah.
So after that, we sailed round to East Falklands.
Yeah.
And it was a case of history repeating itself, because the Glasgow, the Invincible, and the Cardiff were the first ships to enter Port Stanley. Likewise, in the First World War, when that finished, the Invincible, the Glasgow, and the Cardiff were the first ships there again.
Really?
So by this time, as the ship was going round, I was flown over from West Falkland in the Lynx to get to Port Stanley.
When they were en route to Port Stanley.
Yeah, I was flying across.
Flown across by a lake.
I was flown across.
And where was this Argentinian captured boat then?
Well, they actually found it run aground, and they got a crew of they had the Royal Marine landing craft.
Yes.
They got a chief petty officer off there to get it, and the Royal Marines to refloat it, and it was just north of Port Stanley. So we had a couple of days. I mean, they all surrendered at the same time, but we had to take troops from different places who were stuck there. To get them off as quick as possible and get them into different areas. And also, you need a lot of troops to get them round from different points to take over all the prisoners up there that they're from the Argies.
Right. Where were you based at that time, actually, the shore base? Or were you keeping on the boat?
Keeping on the boat.
Yeah, and where was the boat moored?
It was on, well, you had a choice, public jetty or government jetty. It was
right.
The two jetties.
In Stanley Harbour.
Yeah, and whichever one the Royal Marines weren't using,
we'd
come alongside that one.
And what dates were you? You went ashore in Stanley, did you? Yeah, and what dates were that?
The 14th of June, the day the war ended. That was when I first got there.
Really? And that was absolute turmoil, wasn't it?
Yeah, we got there and we got there on it was the 15th of June, it was the day after when we got there. And then by this time, you had paras and Royal Marines all over the place with Argent prisoners.
You've been dropped by Lynx.
Yeah.
Put on this boat. Is that more or less it?
That's it.
And the boat was north of that, and then you came down into Stanley Harbour.
Into Stanley, yeah. Because we had to pick up a lot of troops from the side to bring them down with us.
Okay. And so then you moored up on one of the two jetties.
Yeah.
And you came ashore.
That's it, yeah. Well, we were told, first of all, this is, you're not going ashore because there's a lot of work going on there.
Yeah.
They had booby traps all over the place, but we went ashore anyway. Mm. Now, just after we got there, there was another ship called the Yehuna. I think that's how we pronounce it.
Okay.
It was an RG ship painted black.
Yeah.
And they had a crew in there of HMS Fearless.
Right.
And the lads off the Fearless, their skipper on that ship was Lieutenant, he was Canadian, on loan to the Royal Navy. And the lads on the Fearless called it the Black Pig, after Captain Pugwash's boat. So we used to have to have a couple of runs ashore. But the first night was just the matlows by ourselves off the Tiger Bay. And they actually got one of the bars was open.
Which one?
It was the Globe. Later renamed the Globe and Lonel, after the Royal Marines had painted it out for free beer. But it was called the Globe when we went in there. And I remember at the night time, there was loads of paras, Royal Marines, and even that shore had blokes there from the rapier batteries. Now I remember talking to a couple of them a couple of weeks afterwards. And they was in the rapier batteries that was waiting for these aircraft to come in that was attacking the Nolan Ferry when we fired overhead. And they was actually from that same battery. And they were telling me this because they couldn't believe it. They were sitting there waiting for the aircraft to come in range, and all of a sudden these things went woof, woof over their head, right. Two of them. Right. And took them out. Says, we spoilt the fun. Yeah.
Just describe the scene there in Stanley Harbour.
Well, when we actually
got ashore.
Yeah, there were still dead bodies lying around in the streets.
Yeah. And piles of...
Yeah, they had smoke coming from buildings. Now, this was buildings that had been blown up, and this was actually the Royal Navy had done this when they opened fire. There was four women were killed in Port Stanley, and that was by a bombardment. Because when the troops set a storm the mountains, we'd moved round there with the HMS Glamorgan had been in to start with. The Cardiff went round with the Yarmouth and the Plymouth, I think it was. Plymouth got bombed, and we all fired. The Plymouth and the Yarmouth fired 100 rounds apiece, 100 shells.
Of
4 or 5
shells.
The HE, this was.
Yeah.
Now, because they was only manual ships, and the Cardiff was computerised, we got off more than they did, so we'd actually fired our shells off long before.
Into Stanley Harbour. Right?
No, this is on the hills before the brigades went into attack.
And where were these women killed then?
They were actually killed in Port Stanley.
Where? Which?
It wasn't far from the main street. It was off the side. You had the reason they got hit was they weren't actually aimed for the houses. You had RG guns were actually hid behind the houses.
Mm.
So that's what they were actually going for.
Okay. And so describe it. How much damage was there in the town then?
There wasn't a great deal of damage. There was a you had a lot of the houses, you could see bullet holes all along the front of them. Government House was peppered with them. They had the church, and right next to the church was the police station, with a big gaping hole in the top of that one, where a bomb had gone through it.
Mm.
And then they had this area at the back where a few houses were all burnt out, where these actually artillery pieces where the RGs had been hiding. Mm. And that was it, basically. There wasn't a great deal of damage on the place.
What were... the temperature by that time was pretty getting on.
It was cold, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you had a few sunny days there. It was still cold, but it was
wet.
You had a bit wet and sunshine.
Yeah. And what? So how many Argentinian prisoners were there? And what was happening to them?
Oh, there was thousands of them.
What were they up to?
There was a lot of them were going on with their army patrols, and they was getting rid of booby traps and things. For instance, there's one part we went looking through, and I was going to open this gate, and there was a bomb disposal from the Royal Engineers. I said, don't touch it, get away from it. And I said, what's up then? Now there's four with their cameras from the Tiger Bay looking for some decent photographs. He says, lean over the gate and have a look. And as we leaned over, there was an hand grenade tied to the gate with a pin,